Good morning again. I was asked to open the morning with a thought piece on placemaking. So I really welcome the opportunity to share with you my thoughts, my ideas around placemaking within the context of what we're dealing with, our challenges in Ealing. I have to say first, because I can see some people making notes, we do not have the answer. And nor am I positioning myself as the expert to lead others to the promised land. We still have a lot of stuff to work out. We still have a lot of thinking to do. So please indulge me while I think out loud and share my thoughts with you this morning. So I'm not going to preach or showcase the great things that we're doing in Ealing, because I believe, sincerely believe, that in our own way, we're all doing great things where we are, and the Ignite session that's going to follow on will give some great examples of what's happening across the country. So we're all doing great things, whether it's by design or by default. So this morning, I want to leave you with some thoughts about placemaking, and if there's at least one thought that gets triggered or ignited from our conversation this morning that you can take away to develop where you are, I think that's a good start to the morning. So just to start with some scene setting, because I was asked this question yesterday, where is Ealing? So I just thought I'd say where it is. So we're a West London borough, and we are just west of Hammersmith. We've got 342,000 or so residents. We're the fourth most populous borough in London. Diversity is one of our strengths, and that sounds like London and many of our places where we work in general. So the sort of ethnic profile, we're about just under 54% black, Asian and minority ethnic communities, and 46% white. 76% of our working age population are in work, and the median income that's coming in terms of households is around 38,000. Saying all of that, we still have pockets of deprivation in terms of the indices of multiple deprivation, income, employment and education. Three of our wards, Acton, Southall and Northolt, are very much fall within that category. Like the rest of London, and I think your experiences where you are, we are facing lots of change. We've got Crossrail coming, and we've been watching it coming for a while, but we know and we are confident that it is going to arrive. And because of that anticipation, there are lots of physical changes taking place in the borough in terms of house building and wider regeneration initiatives around placemaking. Ealing has both a suburban feel. We've got over 100 green spaces and conservation areas, and we've got our urban town centres. So we have a diversity of environment, diversity of experience, and diversity of people. So we're just, you know, a real melting pot for change. We've got challenges as a local authority. We, like everyone else, is facing a budget gap. We've got a budget gap of 57 million. We've got a route map of saving targets, strategic change in how we deliver services. So we are dealing with change on a massive scale, both in terms of the physical environment, our communities, and also the way we work as an organisation. But within all of that change, we do have a responsibility, a stewardship, I believe, for placemaking. And it has to be essentially what we are about as a place. So within the structure of a council, the services that I'm responsible for, we've recently moved closer to our colleagues in regeneration. And this coming together has, I say, provoked lots of conversation in the new place directorate about what is place, what is placemaking, what are we about, how do we define ourselves and what we're trying to do so that we understand it, working with colleagues from regeneration, housing development, employability skills, regulatory services to libraries and local democracy and neighbourhood services. So we're trying to get clarity about who we are, what we're doing, and how we communicate that within the council, and also so it makes sense to our residents. So the question then, what is placemaking? It's one of those terms that can be interpreted in many different ways. So when I agreed to come here today, I tried the term placemaking out on a few people. So I just asked the question, these aren't people who work in local government. I asked them, when you say placemaking, what ideas, what does it conjure up? So the first thing I got back is that it's a Trojan horse. It's a way of smuggling in the middle classes. Creating places where people with money want to live and overlooking the people who live there first. Forcing the creation of communities, picking and choosing the people and the things to exist in place. And then some bright spark said, well, actually, back in the day, we called it place shaping. So what that tells us, it's not new. But what it also confirmed for me, that there's a certain amount of cynicism out there in terms of what we are trying to do within the public sector. Behind the scenes, there's a general feeling that we are trying to force community interactions when we're talking about placemaking. But when I got into conversation, generally there was a feeling that actually placemaking is something that the state should be responsible for in terms of safeguarding public spaces. So placemaking conjures up images of place transformation through essentially regeneration of the existing environment into new city or town centre quarters. We all know the iconic buildings, pedestrianised areas, alfresco eateries, product placements not allowed, public art, festivals, markets, and of course the opportunity to shop in some way, shape or form, but just basically lose your money. There may or may not be, within all of this, genuine community engagement. The emphasis generally is a starting point being on spatial design and everything spanning out from that. Generally led by urban planners of some description, commerce, government, to regenerate spaces, whether public or private. However, I would argue that placemaking, as opposed to regeneration, originated in community activism. And sometimes we forget that. The principle was very, very simple. People should be at the heart of urban planning. And I know that we've had some conversations around audience development and working with people as customers yesterday. So let's just understand a bit in terms of the context why I say community activism. I mean, back in the 60s, Jane Jacobs, known as the world-famous apostle of livable cities, championed a community-based approach to urban planning. Now, her seminal text, The Death and Life of American Cities, started a shift in approach to urban planning. She raised the spectre, that awful spectre of ordinary people. Communities being at the centre of what place planning should be about. The text became one of the most influential pieces about how cities worked, failed, and succeeded. Jacobs was not a city planner, and she used observation and understanding, common sense, to show why certain places worked and what could be done to improve those that didn't. So along with William Hite, she led the way in advocating a community-centred, place-based approach to urban planning. And they had five principles core to the approach which they advocated. The first was cities as ecosystems. So Jacobs approached cities as living beings and ecosystems, and she suggested that over time, buildings, streets, neighbourhoods functioned as dynamic organisms, changing in response to how people interacted with them. She explained how each element of the city acted synergistically. For example, how the streets, the pavements, the buildings, the parks, the local economy, agencies and communities all flowed and breathed life into a place. Understanding how all of these elements are interlinked and symbiotically support each other gives a deeper understanding of place and what needs to sustain it, or in some cases, heal it. She also advocated for mixed-use development, the diversity of buildings, residences, businesses, as well as diversity of people and diversity of activities to create community vitality. She saw cities as organic, spontaneous, untidy, by their very nature of being sort of ecosystems. She contested the traditional planning approach that relies on the judgment of outside experts. She was very much an advocate for bottom-up community planning, believing that local expertise is better suited to shaping community development and services. A firm believer in the importance of residents having input in how their neighbourhoods and services develop. Community engagement is something that I know that we are all familiar with. But very often, I think it's often community involvement on our terms. And there's something, I think, a challenge for all of us about being open to community in the broadest sense, shaping and defining what the local offer should look and feel like. Two other things I want to mention in terms of the coming out of the work of Jacobs was the case that she made for higher density, and I think where it applies to us in libraries, very much she saw that there needs to be a critical mass of people capable of supporting vibrant communities. And she was very much an advocate for the role of community enterprise, community shaping what that offer should be. So within this move, if you like, around place shaping, just taking what we have from the 60s to now, some of you might come across the work of Project for Public Spaces, PPS, coming out of Chicago. And that has grown out of the work of Jacobs and White. And they argue that placemaking is not just the act of building or fixing up a space. In other words, regeneration in terms of the hard space, but a process, the actual process that fosters the creation of vital public destinations, the kind of places where people feel a strong sense of ownership and a stake in their communities, and generally with a sense of ownership and stake, generally what flows from that is a loyalty to place, generating a commitment to make things better and get involved. I think that's just what we should do for our lapsed libraries. So spaces have the potential to work best as a destination where there are multiple things to do in the same place, and there are things in that place that prompt social interactions and social connections. So the kind of spaces that foster and enable social capital, and when you look at kind of the genesis of the term social capital, Jane Jacobs' name comes up and Putman. But essentially, social capital is about relationships, it's about connections, it's about social networks, and actually social networks are what actually matters, I think, in all that we do. So reciprocal social connections matter for communities to thrive and for places to thrive. And those reciprocal relationships are built on trust and a recognition of an unwritten, I would say, obligation to the group. So just talking a bit more closely, zoning in now around libraries and placemaking. So what we're grappling with is around how we make the case for libraries and placemaking and retain our integrity in terms of our integrity for library services. Personally, I think if we hold to the truth, and I would say it's the truth and not fake news, that placemaking is more than just buildings and we shouldn't be shying away from making that case. If we're confident enough to make that case, I think we're actually pointing in the right direction. Mayor Berntsen, in her paper Public Libraries and Placemaking, referenced the work of other Danish researchers. I'm going to try and pronounce their names now. Rasmussen, Jochensen, and Scott Hansen. And in English, the title of their piece is The Library in Urban Planning. And they identify three key roles for libraries in urban planning as icons, placemakers, and catalysts, just in terms of how we think about our offering within placemaking. So icons are what you'd expect: landmark, historic, architecturally stunning, possibly quirky, and what comes to my mind, and I will wait for this because it is a Midland quirkiness, the Birmingham Central Library stands out. Even if you don't use the library, you're very clear where it is, you're very clear what it looks like. And if you're fortunate enough to go up in a helicopter, it's easy to recognise from the air. I've not had that experience, but that's what I understand. So libraries as placemakers. Now this morning I was trying to sort of have a think, now what would be a good example of a library that can be badged as a placemaker, revitalising and transforming redundant or underused city areas. And the person who gave me the great answer, I can't see you now, is Antonio. Antonio, yes. So when I asked Antonio this question, he said without hesitating that it's the Canada Water Library in Surrey Quays, which is a Southwark library, which is essentially at the heart of the regeneration of that area. Everything kind of stands out. The library is the focal point. So I would argue that library in particular, and there are others, can be defined as a placemaker. And then the other category they had is libraries as catalysts. So libraries that act as a trigger for, a magnet for community activity, community development. But actually, although they have, and they are researchers, and researchers like to categorise things, I think a lot of this can be interplayed. You can use any of these to make whatever argument you want to make in terms of placemaking. So I'm a great believer that you don't get stuck in a framework or stuck in a matrix. It's important to think outside of that. Berntsen, as I said, Maya Berntsen makes the case, and makes the case quite forcefully, that we need to see public libraries as public space, and think about libraries as public space, and use the arguments around public space to further our case making for libraries. And we need to be at the centre of the debate and arguments for the value of public space in our cities and neighbourhoods. And it's just a hangover from last night. I get a sense that there's a strong case for all of us, and we haven't necessarily got it honed, but there's a strong case for us to elevate our contribution to the battle for public spaces that enable and enrich civic participation and fosters community cohesion and tolerance. All these, we know, are essential elements and pillars, I would argue, of a thriving democracy. Even though there's all that stuff going on, there's some things that I think are fundamentally key. Public libraries are one of the few public spaces left that are actually warm, that are neutral, free, and accessible. And if it's in this public space where I think our interaction as people, our public democracy, can be revitalised. For democracy to thrive, we need to be engaged as citizens. The freedom to read, access to information, and intellectual freedom, freedom of speech, debate, and cultural expression is the DNA of libraries and what I think we are about. Supporting these building blocks of democracy enriches civic participation and is essential to who we are as libraries. Reading, writing, digital cognitive and communication skills are all essential elements of that. So for me, the essence of placemaking is the creation of spaces of mutuality. The real test of good placemaking is how community, how our people use those places to make up the sum of a place. So it's usage, it's people. Whether they be individual institutions, buildings, and connecting the spaces in between, when you're thinking about placemaking, what makes them work is how they're used by the people. So for libraries, it's not just about us providing public space or being a place in and of itself, I would argue, but it's really about what we enable the community to do and to achieve. I've often heard it quoted, and I have to admit I've used this myself, that libraries have moved from collections to connections, from preservation to communication, and the atmosphere in our libraries is created by the people and not the books on the shelves. But personally, when you think it through, I believe it should be a bit of both. We should be just as much about preservation and collections as we are about connections and communication. In the broadest sense, our spaces should be just as much about books as we are about all the other stuff. And I'm not ashamed to make that statement, even though we had a bit of a battle about this over breakfast with my library manager. But personally, as I said, I think it should be about both. And I digress a bit to say why, to just explain why I say that. Rooting for Wolverhampton again, I spent my Saturday afternoon in Wolverhampton Central Library. And I remember just being enthralled by how many books there were. And just walking, and I have very clear memories of this, just walking along and discovering new things to read. It's where I found the works of E. Nesbitt. Very old writer, but yes, I found the works of E. Nesbitt and travelled back in time with her characters in the House of Arden and came across fantasy fiction such as The Enchanted Castle. And I think that pretty much laid the foundation for my obsession now as an adult reader with magical realism, futurism and anything fantastical. Now that happened because I just happened to stumble across the books on the shelves. Okay, yes, there is a case to be made, and I can make the case another time, that there weren't any books by Black, Asian, or writers that weren't European or from a Western European perspective. But the point I want to make is that in all our future gazing, placemaking and strategizing about libraries and the future of libraries, we must not and should not forget the importance of hard copy books. I believe they need to be in the way, to be seen and discovered, to be stumbled over, to be surprised and delighted. And I think when we're talking about the 21st century library and the move to digital and we need to be doing things differently, I think sometimes we can get carried along with that argument and actually forget about the fundamentals. It's challenging though when not everyone sees things that way in my upfront bias for books. We are in Ealing going through a process, just come to the end of consulting on community managed libraries. We're going through a process right across our services of transferring assets to the community. So it's not just libraries. Over the past few years, we've transferred some of our heritage assets, Pitshanger Manor, Gunnersbury Museum, to the community. We've set up trusts and foundations for our parks. So for us, the work around community managed libraries is part of a continuum. And this has been driven by three things: the appetite of residents and communities to become more involved in things that they're passionate about, and us accepting that stewardship for community assets doesn't just sit with the council, but with the communities in which these assets are planted. And secondly, the need to ensure sustainability of these assets and accepting that we don't have all the answers. No matter how fancy and well thought out our strategies might be, we don't have all the answers. And of course, the need for the council to be more efficient and save money. So the big strategic shift for us is to move from 13 libraries run by the local authority down to six. And we were quite upfront with our residents to say that if we didn't have community partners coming forward, that those seven libraries may have to close. So many of you, I'm sure, would have experienced the anxiety, the anger, the frustration that kind of envelops the zeitgeist when residents feel there's a whiff or a possibility of library closures. And what we've experienced, I would say, is the anxiety that the council is up to something again. And this is a plan to close libraries, and it must be stopped. There is anger that the value of libraries to the community and the society is not properly understood by those uneducated bureaucrats in town hall who've never picked up a book. And we must be stopped. And there's also something in the air which is also about the fear of change and frustration. And that this must be stopped. So we did what many of you have done. We did a lot of work around explaining what our proposals are. We had a conference on community-managed libraries. We developed quite a comprehensive prospectus about what that offer might be in terms of place. And we were very clear that community-managed libraries were about, yes, ensuring that the branch libraries remained, but actually they were to act as catalysts for community and neighbourhood development. We were seeking partners who could work with us on that. So we're still through the process. The process, consultations ended, members will make a decision, and we've got a route map that will take us into the promised land, into the change. But what I wanted to share about this whole sort of engagement around community-managed libraries is that it was very, very, very stark relief that our libraries are ecosystems, just using the language of Jane Jacobs. Seeing them as living, breathing organisms with each component, the books, the PCs, the events and activities, our residents, staff and partners, being absolutely critical to the kind of breadth and the vitality and the vibrancy of those spaces. We were challenged about the whole idea of transferring libraries in particular to the community, particularly when some of those conversations were not necessarily echoing what we thought libraries should be about. So there's something in there about challenge, a real challenge about when you kind of let go in terms of placemaking and you're thinking of handing over an asset to the community that actually their vision and your vision don't always coincide. But as Jane Jacobs said, we're dealing with people. It can be messy, it can be unpredictable, but actually it is the outcome that's important. During the consultation, just to show that we, around community managed libraries, we had a group of young women, I'd say they're probably in their mid to late 20s, very well healed from quite affluent backgrounds, I can say that because I do know. And they talked to us about their vision for community managed libraries. They didn't want any books in them. Now, I'm not the person to talk to about that, but they didn't want any books in them. So that was a challenge. They wanted what they defined, if they were to run a community managed library, to have an electronic library. They wanted a space for conversations, for engagement, for activities, where they can debate and have intellectual discourse, but actually they didn't feel that having books was actually necessary for that. So that gave me a bit of a problem. But then we also, so that was a group of quite wealthy young women who wanted to run a community managed library. We also had young people's consultation on one of our estates, one of our libraries. And those young people were white working class, black and minority ethnic young people. They didn't talk about electronic libraries. Well, actually, they didn't talk about electronic libraries. They still wanted books. They were very clear they wanted books. They were very clear they wanted space for conversation, debate, social interaction. So there's something, there's a common thread around all of this change that actually a apart from their online lives, communities are also looking for somewhere in the public space where they can engage. And I think that, for me, endorses this view that actually placemaking is around spaces for mutuality, for community interaction. The placemaking being spaces for mutuality, it does need a commitment to the tribe, to the group, to the community. To engender commitment, there must be ownership and a sense of responsibility. So if we look at what works for us as people, take your library hat off, but what works for us as people, whether placemaking on a grand scale with monumental iconic buildings or the community-managed library, it is about people, it is about the community and how they own and use the space, transforming it beyond just a space to a community destination, the hub of the community. So just as I move to a close, I just want to just ask you to consider Kwanzaa. How many of you are aware of Kwanzaa or have Kwanzaa events in your libraries? Okay, well, it's something new then. So, Kwanzaa takes place December 26th to January 1st. It's a cultural festival that originated in America, celebrated by the African-American community, and it's now celebrated across the diaspora, some of the African diaspora, including some communities in the UK. The festival is secular and marks a time for family and community. Kwanzaa has seven principles, known as the Nguzo Saba, that serve as a guide to daily living. The seven principles are a visible presence during Kwanzaa in the form of the Kanara, which is seven candlesticks. And the candles are lit over the 7 days. The first candle to be lit symbolises Umoja, and the third Ujima. And these are all Kiswahili words. The principles of Kwanzaa, I think, resonate with our focus on placemaking. Umoja symbolises the importance of striving and maintaining unity in the family and in the community. And Ujima symbolises collective work and responsibility. In my mind, the purpose of placemaking must be to foster the conditions for mutuality, for the community, unity, and collective work and responsibility. Placemaking, as far as I'm concerned, is a shared endeavour. It's shared stewardship. And I think the challenge for us is to accept that we don't have all the answers. And that actually, when we invite the community in, we have to be prepared for the challenge, and we shouldn't be afraid of working with our communities to actually deliver services and be up for the messiness that brings in terms of our